This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Today, we're talking about special education. Recent news about the pandemic's impact on special education and students who need support have left some concerned that there's an unmet need right now. We're joined now by two reporters who've been covering this. Dylan Pierce McCoy is an investigative education reporter at WFYI, and Lee Gaines is also an investigative education reporter at WFYI, both part of the new education desk at the station. Welcome to both of you. Thank you for joining us today. Dylan, I'm going to start with you. You've reported recently on some data around the numbers of kids getting special education services. What did you find out?
I mean, we've seen a significant drop in the number of kids getting special education services this year. The advocates that I spoke to were sort of braced for this drop in enrollment. So we've known for months that the number of kids in school is down, and that's not special education, just overall the total number of kids in school is down. But we're also seeing a big drop in the kids getting special education services, particularly in preschool. That's where we saw the largest drop.
Mm-hmm. And so was this drop at all a surprise to the people you talked to?
I'd say that they were expecting this because what we had seen in overall enrollment. So they weren't surprised, but it confirmed fears that they had.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And Lee, you looked into something similar recently about the number of students evaluated for individualized education programs or IEPs in Indiana. What did you learn?
Well, I think it might be helpful to start by just explaining, you know, what an IEP is. Parents in the special education community are very familiar with that term. But for people that aren't, what that stands for is Individualized Education Program. So under federal law, schools have a duty to identify and evaluate children with disabilities. So maybe a parent or a teacher or someone in the school thinks one of their students or their child could benefit from special education. So then the school has to conduct this IEP evaluation, and there are a number of people involved in the process, including the parents, school staff, usually a school psychologist, and some administrators. And so there's all this testing that is done, and the results are evaluated, and then a determination is made. Does this child have a disability that qualifies them for an individualized education program? And so if the answer is yes, then the school has to provide services to meet the needs of this child. And that could be anything from speech therapy to like a one-on-one aid or extra time on tests. So a lot of different things. So that IEP evaluation is super crucial because it's what opens the door to special education services. So basically, I wanted to know, you know, how many of these evaluations had been conducted in recent years, and the state provided that data. And what we could see was that there was a 16% drop between the 2018-19 and the 2019-20 school year in the number of IEP evaluations completed. So raw numbers, there was about more than 25,000 completed when nearly 30,000 were completed the prior year.
And is there a reason that this drop happened? Was it because of the pandemic?
Yeah, that's the reason that I was given by state officials. Also, a special education teacher that I talked to. And then also state officials would tell you that there's been a slight decline in overall enrollment. But I will say that the number of special ed students in the state has actually risen pretty significantly since 2015. And so basically the Department of Education says, you know, during school closures, there was less face-to-face time between educators and students. So that means that maybe like a teacher didn't pick up on the signs that a student might have a disability that would qualify them for special education.
Mm. And I'm wondering if they're trying to figure out how to fix that.
So I talked to the special education director at Muncie Community Schools about this. And, you know, she wasn't super concerned about the drop. She said that what her district does is they do this assessment for all of their kids. And that was super important at the start of 2020, 2021, when a lot of kids came back to schools in Indiana. And so they were looking for not just kids that had disabilities, but kids that might have fallen behind due to the pandemic, but could be caught up with some interventions that aren't necessarily special education services. So basically, she thinks by doing assessments like that, evaluating all of your students, that you can find the difference between students that maybe just need some extra help because they didn't really do well with Zoom school versus students that actually qualify and need special ed services. But I think it's still like I think we will be reporting for years on the fallout of this pandemic and particularly the impact that it's had on special education students. And I don't think we fully understand that right now.
Right, right. And who knows with some of these variants that are coming out, if we're going to be seeing more online schooling again. So it's all kind of up in the air, I guess.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, Dylan, with the drop in enrollment for preschoolers with disabilities, what immediate consequences might come from that?
I think it's just going to be a class of kids that are going to end up with bigger challenges when they start kindergarten. You know, the services that kids get for special education services kids get in preschool are designed to sort of give them a leg up when they get into school. And sometimes they do so well with those services that they don't need special education services when they get into kindergarten and later grades. So if kids are missing out on that, there's going to be an increased burden on schools to help those kids catch up and to help meet their needs and serve them. There's also, frankly, a lot we don't know. It's likely that many of the kids who weren't getting special education services weren't going to preschool at all, because in Indiana, we don't have universal preschool, but many kids who have special needs are entitled to preschool. So if you're not going to developmental preschool, you might not be going to preschool. But on the other hand, there could be kids who weren't going to preschool, but were still getting services. There are private providers. So maybe they're getting therapy, even though they're not in the school system. So a lot of sort of how this is impacting kids, what the consequences are going to be, it's going to take a while for us to know. We're going to have to wait and see once those kids are in school, where they are and how far behind this might have put some kids.
Right, right. And since some of it is going to take time to see, do you know if they've talked about any sort of long-term consequences they're expecting out of this situation?
I mean, I think that, again, is something we just don't know for sure. Educators say that the earlier kids get services, the better when we're talking about special needs. So, like I said, sometimes preschool is all kids need. But none of the experts I talked to seem to think this was insurmountable, right? They really were looking at how schools respond next year, how they fill this gap, and waiting to see how bad this has been for the kids who haven't been receiving services this year.
Right, right. Well, Lee, when it comes to funding for schools right now, especially with respect to special education, how does it look right now?
So in general, I think it's fair to say that compared to most years, Indiana schools are in a really good place financially. So the state has increased funding for education. It's under pressure to increase teacher pay. And lawmakers also specifically increased funding for students with moderate to severe disabilities. Meanwhile, I think it's also really important to note that there's a historic influx of federal aid that's coming to these districts thanks to the COVID-19 relief measures. So Indiana schools will receive an estimated $2.6 billion from the stimulus packages that were passed in December and then this spring. So that's really an incredible historic, but I think it's also important to note that federal money is a one-time influx of cash. So it's going to be spent over about 3 years. So schools have to be pretty careful with how they use it. They don't want to fall off what I keep hearing this phrase, a funding cliff. So they don't want to hire a bunch of people and then not be able to pay them in 3 years' time. Advocates for special education would also tell you like, yeah, this is all great, all this money. But you know what's been a problem for a really long time is that the federal government has never, you know, held up its end of the bargain. And so when the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act was passed in the 1970s, the federal government committed to helping schools pay for the cost to educate students with disabilities. But it has consistently fallen short of the target included in that law. So that leaves state and local officials on the hook for most of the cost of educating students with disabilities.
And when it comes to sort of the federal funds that we're seeing, have you seen any schools using that money for special education specifically, or have they not spent it yet?
So they haven't really spent it yet. Dylan and I have been looking into this, and we requested the spending plans from school districts for this federal money that they're getting. And we've only received some of those plans, and we've only received them for the December COVID-19 relief legislation that was passed. We haven't seen them for the relief measure that was passed in the spring. Schools were actually supposed to submit their spending plans for that money last week. And so Dylan and I did a lot of work talking to people around the state about what they plan to spend this money on. And we heard a lot of things about teacher stipends. We heard about, you know, updating HVAC systems. We heard about facilities, things like that. We didn't hear a ton about special education. So the short answer to that question is that we just don't know yet.
Well, we're getting ready to wrap up here, Dylan. I'm curious, is there anything being done to help kids who need support outside of the school system? Have you heard of anything, any efforts?
So there are organizations that provide services to students with disabilities outside of schools. They provide therapies, but those are typically paid. And we don't know for sure whether more students have been getting those services this year. So we get really clear data about the services that kids are getting through the school system. We can tell you that there's been a big drop in preschoolers getting special education services in schools, but we can't tell you what's happening with those kids outside of school. So I think that's a big open question, and it's going to have big implications for those the needs that those students have when they do go back to school. I mean, there are also advocacy groups, but those are typically focused on helping families get services through schools rather than directly providing services.
Mm-hmm. So I guess I was just going to say, it seems like there's still a lot of unknown. I guess when things start to sort of get back to normal, quote unquote, maybe we'll hear and learn more about what's been going on.
I think that is so true for special education and the services that kids have missed out on this year, but also for education in general. Like, we are all just waiting to see whether kids have big gaps that need to be filled and whether schools are going to be able to meet that challenge.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to thank you both for joining us today. Dylan Pierce McCoy is an investigative education reporter at WFYI, and Lee Gaines, also an investigative education reporter at WFYI. You can follow their work online at wfyi.org/news. I'm Miriam Sobel. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. We're talking about issues around special education and some of the unique challenges people with disabilities have faced over the last year. We'd love your questions and comments on the topic. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, or you can leave us a voicemail, including your first name and where you're calling from, at 866-476-3881. You can also send us a voice message through our free smartphone app. It's called All In Vox Pop. Just search for All In Vox Pop on your phone's app store. Send us your question or comment, and we'll try to get it on the show. With us now is Ross Edelstein, a doctoral candidate at Indiana University who works on issues around accessibility for people with disabilities. Welcome to the program, Ross.
Hello, glad to be here.
Before we get into the work that you're doing, how did you get interested in working on these issues?
So, part of it is because I'm disabled myself. I have autism. And so I really wasn't much doing accessibility until I started a master's in museum studies up here at IUPUI in the fall of 2019. And before that, had worked with some programs at local museums that relate to disability. And from there, it kind of became the focus of my master's program and the work I was doing. And from there, I have worked with a number of institutions, both locally and nationally, and serve on a number of different advisory boards and various things where I provide both my lived experience as well as the various research that I've done and the sort of knowledge of how cultural organizations can respond to better help people with disabilities in their institutions.
Mm-hmm. And that's got to be much more powerful to have someone with lived experience that's also in this field. What exactly are you studying right now for your PhD program?
Yes, so I'm actually starting the PhD this fall at IU. And so a lot of what I'm going to be doing is related to a field that I've sort of coined museum special education, which is essentially all of the various accessibility programs and various supports that museums can do, but also any cultural institution. It's much more widely applicable. But that's sort of what I'm going to be researching and working on at IU starting this fall.
And you mentioned you've done some of that work with institutions like, museums and such. How did you get involved in that kind of work? What led to that?
Well, some of it I had previously worked at. For example, I have done some work with the Indiana State Museum. And before I continue, I do not represent them. I do not speak for them. But I have done some work with the State Museum because I had previously worked there and had asked while I was doing my master's, hey, can I get involved with helping with some of this stuff? And different class projects have been involved with these organizations as well. My internship for the program, every museum studies master's candidate gets a internship. Mine was with the Idle Jorgen Public Program, specifically doing accessibility, but I've also done some work with the Children's Museum, for example, and other various organizations around the country.
And when you talk about the things that you've done, for example, at these museums or like the Children's Museum, what projects are they? Just for our audience to understand, like what is the role of accessibility in museums?
So it kind of goes back to 1990 when the Americans with Disabilities Act was signed into law. And essentially what that act says is that any public-facing organization has to be accessible. And some of the ADA is very clear. For example, the number of parking spaces you have to have, or the fact that you have to have ramps and elevators and what angles they have to be at. But a lot of it is left unclear because it's different for every person with a disability. For example, I have autism. My particular needs with autism are going to be different than someone else's needs with autism. For example, I'm not very good with loud spaces and non-LED lights, whereas someone else, that might be their perfect zone, that might be what they seek. So the role of accessibility is to be able to provide support so that both myself and that person who seeks out sensory experiences has the same experience, as well as making sure that museums are places that are welcoming to everyone. Museums for years and years and years have been behind the curve on a lot of accessibility. And part of this is due to the fact that museums are ingrained in the sort of institutional culture of we are building ourselves as sort of monumental organizations and don't always think of people with disabilities. And it's very common in culture not to think of people with disabilities because you might not interact with them. Or the closest thing you have is my mom's brother's cousin's nephew twice removed happens to have autism. And so that's your only interaction with someone with a disability. And so museums have long either only shown people with disabilities as sort of an other, as, oh, look at this thing that is different, as a sort of curiosity. And so museums becoming more accessible and more welcoming is both working to undo this sort of legacy of institutional trauma, abide with the law, and also just be a better place. Accessible museums are better for everyone.
Right, right. I mean, thank you so much for sharing that. I think that there is often, I don't know if it would be called a stereotype or just a myth or something, that when we think of disabilities, we think of physical disabilities that we can actually see. And so, you know, maybe I wonder if that's part of the problem where it's like, we'll put in a ramp so somebody can get into the building or an elevator, and it doesn't go far beyond that.
Well, like I mentioned, that's often the easy way. As I said, the ADA has specific things that say you can put in a ramp. The ramp has to be at X angle and has to have Y sort of thing involved. And an elevator has to be present, barring, of course, historic structures and things like that. And so a lot of museums, it's easy to, you know, go to your stakeholders and say, oh, we need to budget in X amount. It's also easier to, frankly, get sued if you don't have that, because those are laid out explicitly within the law. Whereas the more invisible disabilities, or disabilities that aren't, you know, having a wheelchair or being blind or being deaf and using sign language, or any other thing that visibly makes it so that you see, oh, this person has a disability, are much harder to get to convince people to fund for. It's getting better, don't get me wrong, but it's still an uphill battle.
Mm-hmm. And in the work that you're doing, have you seen any improvements over the years that gives you hope that it's getting better?
Oh, immensely. From the research that I've done, specifically autism, that's my sort of main focus area because, one, I live it every day, and two, it's sort of how I got into accessibility in general. But the research that I've done on autism is that unless you're the Met and you were doing this like 50 years before everyone else, most museums have started doing accessibility work for autism in the last 5, 10, 15 years. And it's definitely improved. There's still lots of places to go, but it's definitely improving. And part of it is, for example, that museums are starting to reach out to people with disabilities to be a part of it. For example, when I was working at the Idle Jork, let me roll back. There are two people at the sort of master's degree level that I know of who are working in the museum field who have autism. And I'm one of them. And so the Idle Jork bringing me in as the public programs intern to help design things that they're doing, like, for example, they're going to have the first fully built from the ground up sensory room, which is essentially a place for people with disabilities, or really just anyone, to sort of decompress, use different sensory tools, and sort of recover from the sensory aspects of a museum visit. They're the first to have it, in part because I helped design it and because I was there to advocate for it. And in part also because they actually saw a person doing who lives it every day and who needs that. A lot of museums that are bringing on people with disabilities as part of advisory boards, or better yet, staff, hire us. We need jobs. It's a crime how underemployed people with disabilities are. But museums that are starting to hire people in with disabilities, with autism, and it's starting to really make improvements. And even, like, for example, I mentioned I'd done some work with the Children's Museum. One of the things I did was I looked over their social narrative that they put out to help people with autism be able to visit during COVID-19. And I made a couple suggestions on that. Suggestions that, now, I might be biased here, but I think that they were really good. Like, for example, having Rex at the end with a mask on to help reinforce the concept of masking. And so I think that it's really important to involve the fact that museums are involving people with disabilities and not just, you know, going to, as much as involving organizations that help people with disabilities is important, making sure that you're involving people with disabilities themselves is critical to making sure that any program that you run is successful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the lived experience can't be replaced. You know, that's very valuable. For our listeners, if you have any questions or comments for the show, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. You mentioned the sensory room at this museum that you helped design, and it's the first one of its kind there. What's the importance for our listeners to understand that a sensory room is able to provide for folks in a museum?
So sensory rooms are but one of many options a museum can do. I do not want to make it sound like it's the end all be all of accommodating people with autism. The most important thing is helping to change your internal culture. A sensory room, however, is a great support because it provides a space that generally is away from the sort of hubbub of a museum. In the Idle Jork, it's not necessarily it's a quieter space. I believe the Idle Jorg has been mentioned on this station a number of times, but it's a quieter space. It's not necessarily as loud and busy, but for someone with autism, even that, even, you know, a small school group or a family with kids who are, you know, having a great time, that loudness can drive someone to have a bad experience. And the sensory room provides that sort of place where you both have provided sensory tools like fidgets and a couch to lie on and things like that, but also gives you a chance to decompress and be away from everything else. The fact is, and this isn't to knock down museums that have had to do this, because it makes sense. Most places that have them, it's a converted space. It's a storage area you weren't using. Versus the Idle Jorg, which happened to be doing a renovation and was able to add that to the budget, as opposed to, well, now we have to figure out a space that we already have. So that's sort of, but it's one of many different supports. Not everyone who has autism, for example, is going to need a sensory room. And in work that I've done in the past, I found that, again, most people who ended up using a sensory room that I ran a survey on, that was a more temporary, attached to an event version, most people who used it did not have autism. Most people just needed a break from a loud experience. And that sort of space, again, it might be designed with people with autism in mind, but it's not just for people with autism. Accessibility isn't just for the people who are being sort of chosen or designed for, rather.
Well, I was wondering, you know, with your expertise and with what you've been studying and what you've been working on, is funding the biggest problem for providing accessibility, or is funding an easy get? It's just people taking the time to actually research and put it together.
It's both. Funding is, you can find funding. And finding funding for accessibility should be a line item budget for any organization. It should be up there with maintenance. You can find funding. You just have to find it with all the rest of your funding and make your budget available for it. Don't just fund things with grants. Sorry, I got a little tongue-tied there. The most important part, however, is making sure that everyone at your organization, not just, you know, the people who are going to interact with the public, are, you know, aware of the needs of people with disabilities. It's about making sure that your fundraising staff interacts with people with disabilities so that they can see what they're fundraising for. It's about making sure that the president of your organization interacts with guests with disabilities, because we don't want someone sitting up in an ivory tower who never interacts with people. It's about making sure that people with disabilities aren't just something that is, you know, a box to be checked, because we're not. We're people. We are human beings who have every right to be as comfortable as everyone else. And making sure that your museum is accessible is everyone's job. And that's one of the big things that I have seen organizations that have been successful are ones that have made sure that it's everyone's job to think about it.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have about 2 minutes left here. I'm curious to know, how did the pandemic affect any of this? Did it highlight? I know for so many groups and individuals, the pandemic highlighted a lot of issues and inequities. Do you feel like that was the same thing for folks who are disabled?
Yes. A great example is the whole work from home thing. People with disabilities have been asking to work from home for years. I have had to, my biggest challenge is that I can't write. My brain and my hands do not connect in any really meaningful way for small motor skills. And so I've had to use a laptop for years. And for a lot of things, I've used my own laptop for a lot of work that I've done. The fact that all of a sudden now everyone has been encouraged to work from home, when people with disabilities have been advocating for it for years and years and years, and it's been possible for years and years and years, is one of the big things that has been almost an I told you so moment. There's also the fact that a lot of places have been able to look at what they've been doing. I could go on and on about it, but it definitely has highlighted a lot of the inequities.
Right. Well, I want to thank you so much for sharing your experiences with us. Ross Edelstein is a doctoral candidate at Indiana University who works on issues around accessibility for people with disabilities. We'll be back after a quick break with some more guests to talk about special education and efforts to help students transition out of high school. If you have any questions or comments, you can leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Sobe, back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. We're discussing special education in Indiana, how students and teachers were impacted by the pandemic, and how schools are preparing for the coming school year. As always, we'd love to hear your questions and comments. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, or you can leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. With us now are two guests from the Indiana Secondary Transition Resource Center, Director Kathleen Hardy Hansen and Research Associate Michael Nevins. Welcome both of you to the program. Michael, can you tell us your connection to this kind of work and how you got involved?
Sure. I've worked with the Indiana Secondary Resource Center for 3 years now. I've been a teacher for 22 years and really enjoy the work, and my passion's there with transition. We do, as the center, we're a project of the Center on Community Living and Careers at the Indiana Institute on Disability and Community. We create a lot and conduct a lot of professional development activities, resources, and products that support teachers and students with disabilities as they transition from school to their adult lives.
Mm-hmm. And what is your personal connection with this that got you involved in this work?
Well, I mean, I was a teacher, education major, and as soon as when I was doing my undergraduate, took some classes that just, it became very apparent the transition was my passion. So that's how I ended up focusing on that. I wasn't an education major at first. I just kind of decided that was what it was going to be after working around some people with disabilities. But transition quickly became what I was most passionate about.
Well, Kathleen, what is your personal connection to this topic, and how did you get involved in special education?
Well, I have a child that is 27 years old. He has significant disabilities. He has cerebral palsy is his official diagnosis. He doesn't walk. He doesn't talk. He's tube fed. He's still in diapers at age 27, but he's really, really smart. And he uses a communication device. And he's the happiest, most fun person that you'd ever want to meet. And so from the time he was born, he had a traumatic childbirth and was born dead and revived. And so I feel really incredibly lucky that I was am able to parent him still. But I, as you can imagine, just keeping him alive the first part of his life and then getting him all the education from preschool. The first time I tried to get him into preschool, I was told we don't take children like yours. And so I had to call the Children's Law Center in San Francisco and make sure I knew what my rights were and really fight for that opportunity. And it was actually Indiana Institute of Disability and Community that helped me during that time. We just moved to Indiana, and that's how I was first aware of the Institute. And then I got my master's degree in policy and created a family health policy, because when person has a disability in the family, it affects every member of that family. And then went on to get my doctorate in the School of Public Health to make sure that all quality of life measures were there for every member, regardless of ability or disability or any other factors. So I spent many, many years advocating within the school system for my child and other children. I worked with physicians trying to help them fill out paperwork to get children what they need within the school system. And so that's why I'm passionate about this whole thing and am thrilled that I'm able to be helpful to schools and teachers and ultimately families and students with disabilities as they're transitioning from their high school experience into adulthood.
Well, thank you so much for sharing that story and just your experiences. When it comes to transitioning, Kathleen, what does it mean when we're talking about the work that you do?
Well, I think all parents of high school students know that adulting is a significant transition for their children. And even for any child without a disability, that transition into adulthood has far-reaching effects. It's not just what are you going to do for a living, where are you going to go to college, how are you going to live, where can we afford for you to live. But when you have a disability, your child has a disability, depending on what that disability is, what are the enabling factors, what are the disabling factors, how is the work environment or the school environment set up to be able to support your child in the way that they need to be supported, and helping your individual child and helping teachers help their students to be able to begin advocating for themselves, whether it's from doctor's appointments, how do you explain your disability to your professor, how do you make friends with people who don't know you if you've grown up in a certain school system. So there's so many pieces of that, and that's why we really, I don't want to jump ahead of your questions, but we really work so hard on looking at individual education plans and post-school outcomes. So that's indicators 13 and 14. And I'll let you go ahead and ask more questions because I'll take this down a road.
Yeah, no, I mean, there's so many things we can talk about on this topic. But I will ask Michael, I mean, as Kathleen mentioned, these individualized education plans, and early in the show, we talked about IEPs. What is a transition IEP? Is that different?
Well, it is an IEP, and what it is it focuses once the student becomes in Indiana, either going to turn the age of 14 or going to enter their ninth grade year, that's when the transition IEP can start. If it's needed, it can start before that, but that's when it must start. And it focuses on the student. It individualizes and focuses on the student's post-secondary goals in employment, education and training, and independent living skills. And then it's all about what the student needs then, so that plan, so then it can focus on what they want for their life after high school.
Mm-hmm. And how do teachers help with the transition of students out of high school, Michael?
Well, they're it. They're the main ones that are doing that. So that's why the IEP is so important, the transition IEP. So writing that IEP right and really focusing on the student, they're the ones that help carry out that plan and are responsible for carrying out that plan for the student. So I always like to think of the IEP as like the blueprint of what we're going to do with the student, and to have those goals with the student, the student's wishes in mind, the student's goals is the most important. And that IEP will set up the activities that are going to lead towards what that student wants to do and the annual goals and any assessments they might need. So everything is in that IEP that leads towards those student goals.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And if I might jump in just to support Mike and what he's saying too, that IEP also is the main document that is agreed upon in annual case conferences. And that case conference team has, you know, all kinds of the student or the teacher of record, the student is part of that, the family, the parents are part of that, as well as, you know, several teachers. And if they need any supports like physical therapy or occupational therapy or speech therapy. And I think what is so important are those great teachers out there that really are relationship developers, and they bring that team together and get everyone on the same page to do the right thing by the student. And sometimes it's difficult when you've got this huge caseload and you've got families that are going in many different directions. But the IEP is sort of that main document to keep everyone on the same track.
Mm-hmm. And Kathleen, when you're keeping people on the same track with this IEP, is there a way to measure success that it's working for students?
Well, I mean, that's another part of what we do. And yes, the short answer is yes. And we can look at, we monitor over 600 IEPs twice a year. We have a proactive monitoring that we do for every school or for a third of the school districts. And then we have the federal monitoring that we do for another third of the school districts. And in that proactive time, we really look at, are there elements of compliance for the federal government? And then are the state of Indiana actually has an incredible standard of quality. So they go beyond compliance and look for these quality measures. And so we are looking at those measures as well. So we are able to then give reports to each school district and offer some technical assistance to those who didn't do as well. And, you know, we honor those who do very well and are in 100% compliance and quality IEPs. But I think the really interesting part, the most telling part, is the other data gathering that we do, which is for Indicator 14, which is the post-school outcomes. So we look at what are the outcomes for these students 1 year after they graduate, so that we're looking at measures, what I call from a public health area, measures of quality of life, but it's two of the most important parts of anybody's quality of life, that they're able to engage in education and training and as much independent living as they're able to, and then employment rate. And we're looking at specifically competitive and integrated employment. You know, it's the statistics aren't really good in terms of the division of people with disabilities and without disabilities. And when we're looking over the lifespan over time, I think 19% of people with disabilities are employed, compared with almost 66% of those without disabilities. And when we're looking at specifically right after graduation, it's about half of those with disabilities are employed, compared to those without. So we look at what is it that we're doing in this transition IEP that Mike was talking about. And Mike has over 20 years of experience as being a school teacher, so he really knows what he's talking about, because he's worked with a variety of students with disabilities. But when we see that those IEPs are written well, that they have this relationship element where they've really connected with those families and with those students, that then the outcomes for Indicator 14 are much greater and much more positive. Even during COVID, this last year, this was our first year that we had this contract to work on this, we saw that when parents and students found that their teachers were supportive, even if they didn't have a job or they had to drop out of college because they didn't have the supports that they needed, that they felt like they were more able to be successful in the future. They understood that it was about COVID, and they had many, many good things to say about their school experience. When students didn't feel like they were well supported, then they didn't have such good things to say about their school experience, and their outcomes were not as positive. Mm-hmm. So we're learning a lot. Our main purpose of this is to really see what we can do for future students, to see how much better we can do to provide those outcomes so there isn't such a disparity in the long term as well as in this short run of 1 year out.
Mm-hmm. Well, when it comes to disparities, Michael, I'm wondering if you feel, you know, in your expertise over the years, if special education has improved or changed in any significant ways.
Well, improvement's kind of I don't want to imply that it was ever really bad. I think that we're always adapting. And as special ed teachers and administrators, that's something that we just always do. So I do think that we're adapting and that we're really finding best ways, especially with COVID, to do things. And COVID actually did point out some things that we needed to work on, but it also shown, I think, teachers and just from our office on how we train too, some different ways that we can do things. And so things aren't ever going to be exactly the way they were, but I think COVID has shown teachers some different ways to help with that relationship piece and how important that is and how to build. So yeah, I think we're always getting better. But it's just that's kind of the process.
Right. Well, we have about a minute and a half left. I wanted to ask, you know, is the relationship between teachers and parents an important part of IEPs and just in general coming up with a plan?
Oh, yes. And it's very important. And it's important for the schools and teachers to work on how we always talk about building relationships with students, but part of it is also building relationships with parents. And that's why that transition IEP, there's parts of it. It's not just something that's done by the school. The parents should be a part of that process and the school should work towards bringing in parents to making them feel like they're a part of that process. So yes, it's very important that parents are a part of that.
Well, Kathleen, 30 seconds here real quick. Can you give our audience some tips on where they can go to get resources if they're looking for something?
Oh, absolutely. So if you can go to our website, our Indiana Secondary Transition Resource Center, and the abbreviation for that is INSTRC. And if you just Google that and go to our website. We're part of the Center on Community Living and Careers, which is part of Indiana Institute on Disability and Community, part of Indiana University. So that's a big load of words there. But go to that website and you will find every resource that you can imagine and call us. Just give us a call, send us an email, and we'll answer the questions that you might have.
All right. Well, I want to thank you both for taking the time today. Kathleen Hardy Hansen, Director of the Indiana Secondary Transition Resource Center, and Michael Nevins, Research Associate at the Indiana Secondary Transition Resource Center. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. I'm Miriam Soeb. Thanks for listening. This is All In.